Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why did soldiers on the front lines of one of the deadliest wars lay down their arms and play soccer with the very men they were supposed to shoot? We'll revisit the Christmas Truce of 1914. Then, the science and politics of compassion. What brain scans and humanitarian campaigns are telling us about the human condition? World War I was one of the deadliest periods in human history, but it was also the time of one of the most profound, impromptu expressions of humanity. Tens of thousands of soldiers on the front lines laid down their arms, exchanged gifts, songs, and makeshift soccer balls in what became known as the Christmas Truce. How did the peace come about? And what do the historic events tell us about humanity? Stanley Weintraub joins us now. He's a professor emeritus at Pennsylvania State University, a historian and author. His more than 50 books include Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Welcome, Stanley Weintraub.
Glad to be with you.
I thought perhaps we should start with a little bit of context of what was going on during World War I in 1914 before the Christmas Truce.
We have to think that Christmas was not on the minds of soldiers on either side in mid-December 1914. The weather was cold, rain just above freezing. Where the Christmas Truce began was in Flanders, the area of Belgium, France, just below the North Sea and the English Channel, where the land was actually below sea level, held in by dikes and bulwarks and seawalls. They were living in miserable conditions because everything was muddy. The troops on both sides had dug in trenches. There was a stalemate that had taken place just after the bad weather began in late November. They were living in terrible shape. The trenches were flooded. Cold rain and mud had made things worse. Unless soldiers in mucky hideaways stayed awake, they could drown, quite literally sinking into the liquefying mud. Many slept erect where they could. It was very difficult to accomplish one's bodily functions or sleep or eat under those conditions. And so there was not much fighting. It was a matter of live and let live until the weather got better. And it was under those conditions that the Christmas Truce began. A German soldier who later became a famous artist named Otto Dix was on the front lines, and he described the landscape as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. So under those conditions, it was a live and let live situation until something happened that made a Christmas truce Christmassy. And that began on both sides independently. The British, during the Boer War, that is the war in South Africa in 1899-1900, had sent brass Christmas boxes to the troops thousands of miles away, figuring that they'd be lonely and unhappy that far away. And Queen Victoria, in her last years, arranged for this. These were small brass boxes filled basically with chocolates, and the troops loved getting them. Some of them claimed that having them in their pockets actually stopped bullets. But in any cases, in 1914, military people remembered doing this and decided, let's do it again. And so they prepared brass Christmas boxes to send across the North Sea to Belgium and Flanders for their troops, basically, again, containing chocolates, in some cases other kinds of goodies. The Germans got wind of this, and they prepared wooden boxes, pretty much the same size, pretty much like 3x5, and they put in them sausages and typically German goodies and cigars and cigarettes, and these were sent to the troops. But the Germans had something else they could do that the British couldn't. The Germans originated the idea of the Christmas tree, and their idea was the tabletop Christmas tree, not the big monsters that we have over here. The Christmas trees could be brought into the front lines quite literally by the Germans because they, after all, had a ground connection to Germany, which the British didn't. The British had to cross the water for it. And so the Germans brought in Christmas trees and had them already fixed with candles attached. Lighting candles would have been a serious mistake in the front lines, but the Germans decided they'd do so anyway. After all, there was this live and let peace. And they take a chance that bullets might fly. And on the bulwarks of their trenches, many German soldiers propped up the Christmas trees and lit the candles and waited to see what would happen. In some cases, there were some shots fired at them. In most cases, the British were intensely curious as to what was going on across the front lines only 60 or 70 yards away. You have to remember that the distances between the enemies was actually shorter than the length of a football field, but they were separated by trenches and by very bad weather and by bulwarks above the trenches. The British actually crawled out into no man's land, the area between the trenches, to see what was going on. And the Germans, seeing that, crawled out too. And pretty soon, there was some camaraderie in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve. There began the actual Christmas truce.
I wanted to back up because, as I understood from your book, this actually did begin perhaps mid-December, a few weeks out.
There were a few cases about the 19th of December, in other words, about a week before Christmas, when this live and let live policy in that bad weather resulted in temporary cessations of shooting so both sides could retrieve their wounded and their dead and bury the dead. And they got to know each other that way, and they discovered that they were people like themselves. You can demonize the enemy from far away, but you can't demonize your enemy when the enemy is close up, especially when they look like you. And this is one of the reasons why we haven't had Christmas truces before or since. In most cases, the Christmas truce, which was unique in 1914, couldn't happen because of the cultural differences, the cultural distances, in fact. This couldn't have happened in World War II fighting the Japanese. It couldn't have happened with the Nazis who didn't believe in Christmas in World War II. So this was a very unusual situation when both sides loved Christmas trees and Christmas gifts and sang Christmas carols and looked like each other.
I thought there were very many interesting occurrences in your book that describe what was going on. There was one particular time about a week before Christmas when the Germans ostensibly slipped a chocolate cake into the British lines with an invitation to a concert.
They said it was their captain's birthday, and they were going to have a concert for him, and the British could listen. They weren't Christmas carols, but this was something that had happened in an earlier war, the idea of a concert given by another side. During the Civil War, there were occasions when North and South had trumpet competitions across the lines. They had cornets and trumpets and bands. Now, they didn't really meet, but there was this musical competition. In World War I, at least in the first year of the war, the two sides on Christmas Eve sang to each other. The Germans began it singing Silent Night, and although they sang it in German, the tune was familiar to the British. They sang it, too, in their own language. Songs went back and forth between the sides during the darkness of Christmas Eve, and pretty soon there was competition again. The Germans had a singer from the Berlin Opera named Walter Kirchhoff, who was called on to sing, and he sang Christmas carols very lustily across the trenches. It sounds unbelievable, but when you realize there was less than the length of a football field between them, and they were bogged down in rain and mud and unlikely to try to advance or fire, it's easy to see how this could happen. The French hated the Germans because in 1870, the Germans had warred on the French and taken the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine away from the French. Theoretically, they weren't going to have any Christmas truce, and censorship claimed that they didn't, but the French sent out a singer from the Paris Opera who sang to the Germans O Holy Night. And so there was a very strange, almost dreamlike atmosphere that was beginning to permeate both lines.
So there actually says something about two things here. One is, as you mentioned, the demonization of somebody who's right in front of you, which is a little bit harder to do. It also speaks about this kind of shared cultural connection, but it's also the power of music.
The power of music certainly had a lot to do with it. The British were far more interested in singing bawdy songs to the Germans, which they did, and I quote several of them in my book. The Germans were amused by it and knew English. This was, again, one of the unusual factors. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England before the war. They had had jobs as barbers and taxi drivers and waiters and other kinds of jobs that didn't require a good deal of schooling, but they learned English. and their officers and some other senior people in their lines learned English in school. The British didn't learn German, but the Germans learned English, and they could speak to the British, and they could exchange jabs at them and sing at them. So there was a cultural mix that couldn't have occurred in any other wars. One thing they wanted to do, as they had done before, was bury the dead. They could get together more closely if they could cross their lines, which were pockmarked by shell holes filled with water and also blocked by corpses that had been there for quite a long time. They wanted to bury them. And somebody got the idea, which spread across the lines, we could play football in daylight if we had a clear area. And so they agreed that after dawn, they would get together between the lines, they'd fill in the shell holes, and they'd bury the dead. And they did in many areas in the 300-mile length of the front lines from the North Sea to the Swiss border. And that meant the Belgians and the British and the French and the Germans on the other side, who included Austrians and Bavarians, who were far more peaceful-minded than the Prussians on the German side. They did bury the dead in joint ceremonies. Their chaplains came out and officiated, and they did actually play soccer, football in their language. At first, I didn't believe this happened. I had read little bits about the Christmas truce, and many historians said, well, this, of course, was legendary, and the whole idea that they could have played football is quite mythic. But I looked it up in the Imperial War Museum in London and in archives in Germany and in letters sent by the troops. And certainly they played football. They described it very accurately. They used improvised balls and goals. And their official documents, the company diaries, even had the scores.
And so who won?
The Germans won most of the games. And they were very proud of that. But the important thing was that they were able to get together on Christmas Day and pretend that there was no war going on between them.
Here we have these soldiers on the front lines laying their weapons down and fraternizing with the other side, despite the fact that it's a court-martial offense.
But you see, they had gifts they could give out. They had their Christmas boxes, and they had other presents sent from home. The British were loaded up with presents because the newspapers had publicized the fact that the troops need gifts, and they were loaded up with mince pies and other such things. The Germans had never seen a mince pie, and the British were glad to get rid of a lot of them. There was a lot of trading back and forth, and in one case, I found a German had traded his helmet, the Tickelhaube with the horn-like device at the top of the helmet, to a British soldier. And a day later, he came back to the soldier and said, we're going to have an inspection. I need to borrow it back. The British had no helmets yet. It would be 2 years into the war before they had steel helmets. They traded food. They traded various kinds of equipment. And they mixed together. And they did so until the German higher-ranking officers and the Allied higher-ranking officers began to be concerned. After all, there's no war if the soldiers don't fight. You've got to get them back to fighting again. And they actually managed to do so. It wasn't easy, because once you meet your friends who are the enemy and you see them face to face, it's hard to fight them again. One soldier actually met his former barber, who's German, and he said, you need a back and sides, sit down and I'll take care of that. And he trimmed his hair on the front lines. What do you do under such circumstances? They sang together. They ate together. The only thing they could do from the higher up angle was to move them out. In other words, to replace them with reserves who had been indoctrinated to hate. And so they pulled out many of the troops on the front lines and after Christmas replaced them with other troops and forced them to fire again.
Just a quick reminder that you are listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Stanley Weintraub about the historic impromptu ceasefire of World War I, known as the Christmas Truce. You described this as everywhere you looked, people were talking and playing. How many of the front lines really were engaged?
It depended on the commanding officers involved. There were areas where there was no fighting, And there were areas where the senior officers said, I order you under pain of court-martial to keep fighting. And so some of them had to shoot. When they did, they generally shot high up in the air over the heads of the troops opposite them. They refused to have actual fighting go on. I found a number of instances of this where the junior officers on both sides would go out into no man's land and meet, and they would say, we're being forced to fire again. We'll fire high up in the air. We'll send a flare up to let you know, and then you can go into hiding or into your trenches. They did this in very surprising ways. Often they exchanged gifts. A German would exchange his gloves for a British scarf, for example, and then they'd go back and they'd fire a flare. A few hours later, the fighting would resume. In some cases, it lasted into New Year's, not because they were celebrating New Year's Day, but because the weather was still so bad.
One of the instances that you described in your book was when a French person warned the Germans to, quote, be on guard tomorrow. A general is coming to visit our position. For reasons of shame and honor, we will have to fire.
And, of course, they did. But there were some very strange things that occurred that are almost unbelievable. Soldiers would write home about them and talk about them as if they were a waking dream. And I researched this over the years by going to the British newspaper library in North London in Colindale and reading the letters to the editor in provincial newspapers where soldiers had written to their wives and girlfriends and parents and said, you won't believe what has just happened, and went on to describe the meetings between the two sides and the fraternization. The newspapers were sent these by the people who received those letters, and they printed them. So I found literally hundreds of such letters, both in Germany and in England, that were printed before censorship began.
You mentioned the media's response, and it sounded from what you found in your research that there was considerable resistance in mass media, other than these letters, to treat this as important as you see it as, like they really downplayed it. What is your assessment of this?
The managements of the newspapers were trying to be ultra-patriotic, and they didn't like this idea, but the pressure for such news was terrific. As the soldiers said, seemed like a waking dream. But a dream doesn't last. You wake up, and you wake up to reality. The war began again, and there would never be another Christmas truce in military history.
And do you think we never have another Christmas truce in military history, partly because the leaders who, you made very clear, this is war is being driven by the leaders, not by the soldiers, learned from this?
Well, the military leaders are a professional group. Their job is to win wars, to fight and defend one's country. And soldiers, for the most part, in a big war, are drafted. They come from the farms and the factories and other such places, and they're not professional. They have no careers dependent on winning a war, and they have to be propagandized into wanting to win a war. It's very difficult, for example, right now, to try to convince a soldier, even though he's an enlisted person in Afghanistan, that there's something very important for his own country involved in fighting and possibly dying in Afghanistan.
When you look at this in a historical context and you do put it in today's time frame, which, for example, in the Afghanistan case that you mentioned, what do you take away as the wisdom of the Christmas truce?
The wisdom of the Christmas truce is that we're all the same, and there are many reasons why we should be friends instead of enemies. And that's hard to accept if there are no cultural connections. It's hard to accept if you have the other side unwilling to admit that there is anything that you represent that is going to create friendship.
The other takeaway that I thought about is the role of leaders and the role of mass media in some cases in being able to convince people of the either reasons for the war and the demonization of the other and all of the beliefs that can arise from that. And one thing that I underlined in your book pertained to a particular leader, which was Hitler, who would not participate in the Christmas truce.
He didn't believe in Christmas, so he wouldn't participate. He hated the enemy, and the enemy didn't believe anything that he did. But you mentioned the mass media. That's a big difference now, too. The mass media during World War I, 1914, were largely the newspapers. And the newspaper owners represented, in effect, big business and therefore big government. That has become dissipated. Radio came in, television came in. I was in Korea in 1951-52 when live television existed in America, and but it brought home the reality of war, what it was really like visually. That hadn't happened before. Now we have other mass media, all the electronic media, and it's very difficult to try to manipulate all of the sources of information. And so it's difficult now to develop one kind of bandwagon that everybody follows.
Your ultimate conclusion at the end I thought was quite beautiful. You said you conclude that the Christmas truce is a celebration of the human spirit and a moving manifestation of the absurdities of war.
But it's only true when you have cultural relationships with your enemy.
It would be interesting to see what cross-cultural relationships could generate as well. Because there are things that all humanity shares. It may not be Christmas. It may be something else.
In the past, we could go back to ancient Greece and, let's say, the war is described in the Iliad, and find there were temporary truces to bury the dead or for some religious reason. They didn't last, and the war began again. There were truces in other wars, basically, again, for burying the dead and retrieving the wounded. But the cultural differences have become far greater.
The other thing that you had said was that the war continued not because the soldiers wanted to fight. In fact, the soldiers were in some ways trying to prevent their so-called enemy from being harmed. And so it was really the generals and the political leaders that then had to change the soldiers on the front line in order to continue a war.
Yeah. If you have a military defeat, your government's going to go down. If you have a military defeat, your general is going to lose his job. So a lot of this has to do with the intentions and the needs of the people who make the decisions.
And let's conclude with the counterfactuals that you started, which is, what if?
What if people refuse to fight? We've had mass demonstrations in cities in the Arab countries in North Africa, which suggest what can happen when people get out in the mass and dare their governments to do what they don't want them to do. It's possible. It's possible, but it's not easy, and it can be very costly and dangerous and harmful to the people involved.
Well, Stanley Weintraub, thank you so much. The book, again, is called Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. When we come back, the science and the politics of compassion. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Does compassion and compassion training change our physiology and our sociology for the better? Three experts join us. James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. I'd like to begin with, what exactly is compassion? James Doty, let's begin with you. What's the scientific basis for compassion?
Let me just preface this by saying that sometimes when this comes up, you could get multiple answers from different people. And in fact, there was a person who said, scientists actually do not agree on what the definition of compassion is. And I will tell you that in a general sense, and one that I think is agreed upon by a number of people, it is the recognition of the suffering of another with a desire to alleviate that suffering. And that's not necessarily to say that one has the ability to, or is able to, or in fact act. It is simply that they have a desire to alleviate that suffering.
Paul Gilbert?
Yeah, I think what Jim's point is exactly what we would see as compassion, this sensitivity to suffering in self and others with a commitment to try and alleviate and to prevent it. In the model that we use, this has two psychologies to it. Firstly is the psychology of willingness to engage with suffering, to turn towards it, to try to understand it, as opposed to dissociating, avoiding, or, you know, turning your back on it. And the second psychology is acquiring the wisdom to be able to do something about it. So an example we give is of compassion is that, you know, if you see somebody fall into a fast-flowing river and you think, gosh, you know, I must jump in and save them. So the first psychology is the intention to engage and put yourself forward. But then mid-jump, you suddenly realize, oh, gosh, I can't swim. Unfortunately, there isn't any action behind it to actually alleviate suffering and so forth. And in the Buddhist traditions, there's that we learn to become enlightened in order to enlighten others. In other words, we spend a lot of time applying ourselves to learn how to alleviate suffering. So intentionality is important, but like with being a doctor or surgeon, as Jim is, you then have to put in the work to learn what to do. So full compassion is this process of being orientated to suffering, to pay attention to it, to become aware of it, to try to understand it, the nature of it, the causes of it, and then to apply how to create within oneself the wisdom to know what to do. And finally, in our model, we have three, the flow of compassion. There's the compassion that you feel for other people, the compassion that you are open to from other people, so you're open to the helpfulness of others, and there's also self-compassion. So that's how we would see it in the therapy model that we use.
Ian Wilkinson, would you agree?
I think both the definitions offered so far are helpful, but it might also be useful to add into this that certainly in philosophy and social science, compassion is often defined in contrast to other related emotions such as pity, sympathy, empathy. And in relation to those other three, compassion tends to be identified as a stronger identification and concern for the suffering others than perhaps would be taking place in pity, sympathy, or empathy. These distinctions just work analytically. It's important to add as well that we're actually talking about a very complex feeling, a moral feeling. And when it comes to discerning precisely what's taking place, it always invites, you know, contested definitions. It always invites moral debate. But put set simply, you know, a feeling for the suffering of others and married to a concern to alleviate their suffering, that's a very good place to start.
I think it was Paul who just said also compassion for the self. So it is perhaps not just for others. Would that be accurate?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think a number of people would argue that, first of all, especially in Western society, we have a tendency to be hypercritical to ourselves. And that can, and in fact does, have a very negative effect because it creates a self-image that in and of itself is negative. And then as a result, it's much more difficult to, number one, recognize the suffering of others, but also, in fact, to alleviate suffering. So self-compassion certainly is a critical component in the context of understanding one's ability to give compassion and recognize that to maximally do so, that has to be a component.
Let's talk about the physiology or the biology of what we're discovering through the sciences. James Doty, you're heading up this institute, and seems that the researchers affiliated with your center have been using MRIs to study the impacts of, say, compassion training to become more compassionate. What is it finding?
Maybe we back up just a little bit to say, what is it about compassion that, if you look at an evolutionary construct, what is it about compassion that is so important? And if you look at the development of humans, multiple things happened to make us human, if you will. One is, of course, theory of mind, the ability to see that you have independent thoughts of others or vice versa. The other is the development of abstract thinking, and then, of course, complex language. And those components of our evolution required a significant increase in cortex size. But it also resulted in a requirement that the infant be cared for outside of the womb for up to 15, 20 years, in my case, apparently 30 years. But we have to take care of our children. And unless there was a very strong bonding mechanisms to the family or the mother or the parents, you would not care for your child because it takes significant energy to do so. So for our species to survive as humans with those components, it requires that we care for our young, and it takes a long time for them to develop the characteristics of humans. So that is, if you will, inherent within our DNA. The other aspect is, as we then evolved to the hunter-gatherer tribe, a couple other things had to happen. One is, in addition to this ability to recognize that your child is suffering and to intervene to stop that suffering, to make sure they're not hurt, to make sure they're going to survive, this then translated to these small hunter-gatherer groups. Because if you did not have the ability to gauge emotion or suffering, it would potentially put the entire group at risk. And that's why we have evolved incredible mechanisms to recognize, as an example, microfacial expressions to indicate suffering or emotion. And that's why we also have these connections to those that are within our group to alleviate their suffering, because from an evolutionary perspective, that is critically important to our survival. So then, to take it though a little bit further along in terms of the physiology, well, we know that to survive, we also have to reproduce and we also have to eat. And, of course, what happens when those two events occur is that this is very strongly connected to pleasure centers. And, in fact, we also know that because compassion or caring for the other is such a critical component, those pathways in the brain that are associated with pleasure also increase their metabolism in the context of compassion as well. So it just shows you how critically important this behavior or component is to human survival.
Paul Gilbert, what would you add to this?
The interesting thing is that mammals in particular respond to the distress calls of their young. And the ability to be sensitive to a distress call and respond to it may be one of the early precursors for compassion. The other aspect which is really interesting is the fact that in the evolution of the attachment system, which is what Jim was talking about, the parent is able to regulate the physiology of the infant such that the parent can calm the infant down. So when the infant's distressed, the infant can go to the parent or the parent goes to the infant, and through bodily contact, touching, and various other signals actually stimulates oxytocin and parasympathetic system. Now, these, we think, are quite important in the experience of compassion from others, because that's one of the things I'm interested in, is how people respond to receiving compassion from others. And we think that that system is extremely important in the ability to receive compassion. So when we are experiencing compassion and when we're being self-compassionate, we are actually engaging in a sort of calming process. So the affiliative system and the attachment system, which gives rise to compassion, the ability to be sensitive to distress, then you get an input, caring input from another, and then your distress settles down. We think that's a very important process for the regulation of distress. And in humans is fundamental. You know, when we're distressed, we nearly always turn to others who we think care and love us to find a source of comfort and support. So Jim says, you know, we're biologically set up to be regulated through relationships and in particular through caring relationships. And the other important thing about caring relationships is that caring relationships give us courage. So if you think of something that's difficult to do, you've got a frightening hospital appointment to go to, or you're going through a painful divorce, if you turn to your friends, what you want your friends to do is not to encourage you to avoid the hospital appointment or don't go through the divorce, it's too painful, but what you want your friends to do is to encourage you and support you so that you can go through what is painful to you. You feel supported by them. They will encourage you to face what you need to face. So these mechanisms that Jim is talking about in terms of the way in which the caring system works are very fundamental, because if we don't have people around us who can understand our distress and respond to that distress and therefore encourage us to face things that we need to face, life would become very, very tough. And of course, the people who I work with who are depressed, that's exactly the problem that they often have, is they don't really have much caring in their environment.
Let's widen this now and take a look at culture and politics. When people respond to others, say in a humanitarian crisis, Ian Wilkinson, this is an area that you've been looking at. How does this work in terms of across the globe, humanitarian issues, images being seen from one country to another?
Well, before I begin to try and address that issue, I just want to say where I'm coming from is from a direction of sociology and social history. And so I take the view that whatever biological disposition we might have towards compassion is also is subject to processes of social conditioning and cultural nurture. And from that perspective, one of the interesting things about modern humanitarianism is its relative novelty. It seems that in modern times, we have acquired a compassionate concern for distant strangers that was not present in earlier forms of human society. Now, understanding why that is the case, I think, involves us looking at lots of contributing factors. Some hold that it's related to the ways in which we are emotionally regulated in modern times. And the argument here would be that where we're more controlled in our emotional lives and are more concerned to display traits of civilized constraint, this also has a knock-on effect in making us more alarmed by the sight of the suffering of others and more concerned to alleviate that, remove it from our sight. That's one argument. Another argument is connected to the growth in our capacity to visualize the suffering of others. And it's possible to trace a history of humanitarianism and its development into organized forms of politics as growing hand in hand with the development of our technological capacity to render visible the suffering of others. But, of course, that also engenders lots of other debates about how the visibility of suffering might also erode capacity to feel for others just by the ubiquity of the imagery and its familiarity. We might have sometimes respond to this with, you know, feeling less for what we see. It becomes more mundane. So this is a very, very complicated set of phenomena that we're trying to explain here.
One of the things that I saw in your book, Ian Wilkinson, was about this idea of compassion fatigue, which is, I think, what you're talking about, whether or not people get fatigued from so much suffering in the world and wanting to escape it because it sort of hurts.
I think when it comes to understanding compassion fatigue, it's important to think about this at different levels. For example, if the very notion of compassion fatigue incorporates the assumption that there's a time and place where people are not tired by their compassion, they're not fatigued by it. Historically speaking, I don't think we can look back to a time where there is this kind of untired, unfatigued place of compassion. Historically speaking, I think there's a more concerted, large-scale, organized attempt to care for the suffering of people taking place now than there ever has been in human history. And the very fact that we worry about compassion fatigue might actually reveal the opposite, that we're actually more compassionate than we ever have been and are worried perhaps that there isn't enough of it. But at the same time, as I hold to that view, though, I think when you're looking at the health of people who are involved in serious and difficult care work, there, it might be right to talk of a form of fatigue that enters into that, possesses them through the strenuous effort of care. And so I think in the context of nursing is just one example, then it is a valid category for understanding an experience of burnout that some people have when they're dealing every day with difficult and trying circumstances of care for suffering.
What I'd like to do is now turn to people who have compassion, people who may not develop that kind of compassion, and the training of compassion. Paul Gilbert, I'd like to turn to you because of an introduction that I read in your edited volume where you talked about compassion and cruelty. How would you help us understand compassion versus cruelty and their development?
Well, that's exactly what Ian was saying. The interesting thing about humans is that we are multiples. What I mean by that is there are many versions of us that are possible. So, for example, if I had been kidnapped as a three-day-old baby into a violent drug gang and, you know, whizzed off to some foreign country and brought up as a violent gangster, this version of me wouldn't exist. A very different version of Paul Gilbert would exist. So what Ian was saying is absolutely right. Not only is it our values that change, but we now know that the environment in which we live influences our genetic expression. So the environment in which we grow has fundamental impacts on the kind of versions we become, how our brains mature, how our genes get expressed. The environment is absolutely crucial. And if you look back in history, I'm afraid humans have shown themselves to be potentially an extremely nasty species. Certainly in England, up until about 300-400 years ago, every major city had a torture chamber. Watching people being hung, drawing, quartered was sort of a public entertainment. And, you know, the Roman games. And we can go on, you know, the Holocaust and so on and so on. So, you know, atrocities, what's going on in Syria right now. So the point is that, you know, although we have the potential to be most compassionate, we also have the potential to be extremely cruel. And not only can we be cruel to other people, but we can also be quite cruel to ourselves. So we have to understand compassion competes, as it were, with these other potential states of mind, these other potential selves, these which may well be partly socially created. So one of the points about compassion training is that compassion is certainly a potential, but in many of the traditions, you also have to cultivate it, because for some people, it's a more natural disposition, maybe because of genes or maybe because they come from loving backgrounds. But for other people, you do have to help people cultivate it. And that's where a lot of interest is now, is can you train people to cultivate states of mind that are conducive to compassion as opposed to conducive to greed or competitiveness or an interest in cruelty or watching sadistic movies or whatever it is. So recognizing that humans are multiple, there are many possible versions of us, there are many different states of mind. We can dissociate very easily. We can love our children in the morning and bomb somebody else's children in the afternoon. We're a very odd species in this regard. And therefore, the whole issue of cultivating, choosing, deciding, how should we educate our minds, both personally and at a social level? Because if we don't make decisions about how we're going to educate our minds, it's quite easy for us to become quite an unpleasant individual to ourselves and to others. Finally, taking up Ian's point, we are moving towards a recognition that we are all part of the same human group, and how can we extend compassion and kindness to others as opposed to, you know, the tribalism and the hatred that is also very easy to inflame within us.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the science and the politics of compassion. James Doty, this is one of the areas you're studying. Can you cultivate compassion? How do you do that? And what are the impacts?
I think all of those are important, and let me just make a couple comments. One is regarding Ian's comments. I think one of the reasons that we have much more interest in, if you will, the world stage and suffering that's going on is because we have much more access to that information. And to comment on the other aspect, which is the compassion fatigue aspect, if you see one child suffering, it's very easy to make a connection of sympathy and regard and desire to alleviate that suffering. And oftentimes, though, when you see a large number of people suffering and recognize that you have no ability to impact that, you are overwhelmed and therefore you withdraw because it's so painful and you're protecting your emotions. And certainly this concept of compassion fatigue or burnout within individuals, if you will, in the caring professions such as medicine, healthcare, even policing, and some of these other areas, we are engaged in, if you will, protecting or caring for individuals in society. If you don't feel you have control or boundaries when you are seeing large numbers of people, it can become overwhelming, and essentially you sacrifice yourself trying to help these others when, of course, that doesn't work because if you're not at your best, you cannot care for people adequately. So that's certainly an issue, and it's one that's being addressed. The other aspect of compassion, which Paul alluded to, is this a more clear understanding of how environment or behavior, if you will, impacts the expression of certain genes in regard to the end effect of compassionate behavior. And also the reality that we know, looking at young people or children who've grown up without adequate attachment or bonding, if you will, nurturing or compassion, you can predict that they will have much more increased in the occurrence of disease or cancer, that the illnesses that they have will be more frequent and more severe and more prolonged, and that their longevity will be decreased. Conversely, when you look at people with good attachment, or if you will, who are compassionate, you see some very amazing physiologic effects, especially in the context of the ability, if you will, to train compassion. And what happens is that this has an effect on the autonomic nervous system in that there are two parts. One is the parasympathetic and one is the sympathetic. And the sympathetic system is that which was originated in the context of the earliest development of living beings in the sense that it protected them from injury, and this is what we call the reptilian part of our brain. And this responds to threat. Now, it doesn't have to be threat, real threat, it just has to be the sense of threat. And when that happens, a variety of things occur. If you're an animal on the savanna or a human on the savanna in Africa thousands of years ago, and remember, our DNA has not changed significantly in 200,000 years, if you were on the savanna in Africa and saw a lion, your blood pressure would go up, you would run, your blood would be diverted from your abdomen to your muscles, your pupils would dilate, there'd be this release of epinephrine and cortisol, and you would run, and if you survived, all of those things would immediately go down to normal. And if you didn't, well, it didn't really matter. But in the context of modern society, this reptilian part of our brain, which engages this fear mechanism, for many people is always chronically engaged on a low level. And this was never meant to be how we functioned. And in fact, evolution is a very, very slow process. While modern society changes extraordinarily rapidly, and some people would even say exponentially. So we have not created mechanisms for our evolution and our ability to respond to our modern environment. But that being said, we have evidence that we, in fact, can change our brains, this idea of neuroplasticity, whereby with certain practices, we can go from an engaged sympathetic nervous system to an engaged parasympathetic nervous system, or change the balance. When your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, you relax, you feel a connection to others. The modern part of our brain in our frontal area that is responsible, if you will, for executive function, creativity, is engaged and allowed to function at its best. And what we see in this context is that the blood pressure decreases. These deleterious hormones such as epinephrine or cortisol levels are decreased. And our immune system functions better. And these are all very well documented events that occur when someone is compassion with intent. One of the things that both Paul and Ian commented on in regard to recognizing the suffering of others is that we have a tendency to be somewhat tribal, again, based on our evolution. But one of the components of compassion training is a recognition, one, of your own suffering, but more importantly, a recognition of our shared humanity. And there is evidence that when you clearly understand this idea that we are all, in fact, one, then this allows you to offer compassion beyond those who you know or those who you're friendly with or those in your defined group. As an example, there's research that's been done by David Destino at Northwestern that shows how if you don't identify with someone, it's hard to be compassionate. But if you make an effort to even identify a few traits that the other group, if you will, the out group, how they're like you, it immediately starts to decrease your fear and anxiety, and you're defining those people in a negative way. And this is the power of compassion training, if you will, this ability to go beyond your defined group, which you automatically have a tendency to care for, as an example, a mother to her child, but even a parent to his relatives, but even beyond that, to your community, and in fact, the world community. And frankly, if we don't develop these capacities, the ability of our species to survive, I would suggest to you, is nil.
Ian Wilkinson, this is your bailiwick.
What James has done is he's portrayed compassion in a very rational vein in some of his comments he's just laid out. And I think he's involved in a very important work, which is trying to render the passion of compassion more rational and amenable to rational understanding. And maybe then we can proceed in a more rational way to acquire it and enact it in a progressive manner. The thought that it's evoked in me, in hearing him speak, was that there's quite a lot involved in compassion which seems to escape rationality as well. And I was thinking of the examples in history where there's been great outpourings of compassion at unprecedented levels. If you look at the end of the 18th century, say from the 1760s onwards, a lot of modern humanitarian concerns have their roots there. And when you examine the histories of these things, it's often that people acquire intense, passionate concern for the suffering of others almost as a surprise to themselves. This is documented by Voltaire, who in the early 1760s takes up the cause of religious toleration in the case of Jean Calas, but then is surprised at himself and recognizing that he wasn't disgusted or worried about the torture that was used to exact confessions by Jean Calas initially. But this suddenly awakened to this as a concern. And then alongside any issue relating to religious tolerance, he started to be worried about the injustice of the cruelty that was meted out upon him. And I think, you know, social historians of this period time and time again document the fact that people are often suddenly overwhelmed by and taken up in compassionate concerns, which are a great surprise to them, and then which then perhaps involve them in more concerted political actions to combat the causes, alleviate the effects of suffering. Now, to understand that, I think, requires us to think about human beings as subject to social pressures, cultural forces, which are not easy to nail down into any lab experiment. They're highly contextual. They're often about cumulative effects of ongoing processes. And I think understanding and being able to pinpoint exactly how the dynamics of all this plays itself out is extremely difficult to pin down in any discrete manner. That's not to say I'm not intrigued by and very interested to understand how compassion can be rendered more rational.
Paul Gilbert.
Sure. I mean, I think Ian hits it on the head, really. We're a species that adapts to our environments, and for good and for bad. And this is so we can have societies that are incredibly dissociated, where individuals literally dissociate from the suffering around them. So they go and watch, you know, tortures or people being hanged or guillotined or the Roman games or whatever it is. So we need to understand the way in which culture creates dissociation from suffering. What's interesting, I think, in the modern world is that after the Second World War, there was a very clear desire to create a better world. So in this country, for example, we built a national health service that was the envy of the world. And the idea was that we all pull together, we all work together. What's happened in the last 20 years, and I think Jeffrey Sachs's book, Prize of Civilization, is excellent on this, is that we have drifted back into competitive psychology, where actually it's not about other people, it's about what I can achieve for myself or what my firm can achieve for myself. It's all about competitive edge. In our schools, this is what we tell our children. It's all about you need to get a competitive edge. And that, I think, is problematic, because I think, in my view, that unless we do more of what James is doing in the schools and actually helping children think more in terms of being a member of the human species and that actually we're all in this together and how can we help each other, if we move more and more towards competitive edge, then what we'll end up is more of what we got, which is people doing very bad things on the stock market and in firms and so forth because they're focused on this high sense of individuality. So I think politically, the political question at the moment is how is compassion going to play out in terms of the dynamic between individual competitiveness and coming more to pay attention to the needs of the many. After the war, we were paying attention to the needs of the many. Now we pay attention to the wishes of the few. So these are very important questions for our society.
Thank you very much for being with us here in the Scholar Circle, for sharing your research, and for this really profound discussion.
Well, thank you so much. It was wonderful.
James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research in Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.